you know, you seem to always be working on improving something about yourself. So what is it these days?
I've been working on two things. I am always working on golf and trying to be better at golf. And I've also been trying to learn German, which is a very different kind of endeavor for me.
Steve Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. Levitt is recently remarried, and his wife is German, which explains his desire to learn the language. Talk about how you learn. Are you self-taught or not?
I am primarily self-taught, but you know that one thing I value very highly is enjoyment and happiness, and I'm definitely willing to sacrifice being a better German speaker in order to actually enjoy the German practice I do. So in some ways, it's probably the exact wrong message to send to the people who are listening. But I still think there's some truth to it, right? One of the things that's overlooked about learning a new skill is that the only people who ever get good are the people who keep on doing it. And most people quit, probably rightly quit, because it looks enticing from the outside and isn't that much fun when they actually start trying to learn a new skill. But for me, with German, I definitely have been of the mind that it has to be fun. And if it's not fun, I won't do it.
So that's what Levitt's been working on. What are you working on? We asked Freakonomics Radio listeners to let us know.
Hi, my name is Arun Patha, and I live in Sydney, Australia.
My name is Justin Xavier. I live in Los Angeles.
Natalia, I live in Moscow, Russia.
Amy, I live in New Orleans, and I am an opera singer.
Teacher of English.
I'm a PhD candidate.
I am an environmental engineer, and I definitely could use some help getting more things done.
My ambition is to improve my earning potential, learn more about the world, and unleash my inner math geek.
I want to help my oldest child with her science fair project and work with my younger daughter on her comic book.
Learn to knit a scarf and try new ethnic foods.
I most definitely want to up my guitar playing skills.
I want to read my two-year-old to sleep every night and also take my wife to the movies from time to time.
I'd like to become a better American.
Okay, that is a pretty big wish list. We've got our work cut out for us. Where do we start? Let's start with this guy.
Okay. My name is Charles Duhigg.
Duhigg is a reporter and editor at The New York Times.
And the author of The Power of Habit, and more recently, Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business.
So, Charles, when we put out a call out to Freakonomics Radio listeners and told them that we were working on self-improvement in several realms, and we asked people to tell us what they were most wanting to improve in their lives, I think productivity probably outpaced the others, maybe 3-1 combined.
Wow.
So plainly, the appetite for this is just off the charts. And it got me wondering about why that appetite is so large.
I think it's because our experience matches so poorly with our expectation, right? We're living through this age where they keep on telling us, look, we have all these devices for you now, right? We have email and we have a communications revolution and we have computers on in everything that you can possibly touch. And the idea should be that life gets easier. And instead, it's just getting harder and harder. And that doesn't seem like how things are supposed to go.
So how are things supposed to go? We'll get into that right after the...
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything, with your host, Stephen Dubner.
The thing I would most like to improve on is my...
And the thing that I most want to improve about myself is my productivity.
When I told Steve Levitt that so many people wanted to hear about productivity, he was not at all surprised.
Productivity is the key to everything. If you can be 10% faster at getting the same thing done, then you got 10% of your time to do something you'd rather do. So when it comes to economics, if there's a single measure we should care about, it's the productivity of workers. I give a lot of credit to our listeners that they think like economists when it comes to productivity.
And how does Levitt rank himself on the productivity scale?
I'm actually a strangely productive person, and I'm not quite sure why, but you give me a pile of stuff to do, I get it done quickly. whether it's something academic or when I got a new apartment, for instance, I took my four kids with me and we did all of the furniture shopping for the entire apartment, for a six-room apartment, in under 2 hours, including the checking out and buying everything with four kids.
Okay, how'd you do that? What are your tricks?
To tell the kids that everything looks great. Let's do it. Perfect. You got 15 more minutes and then we're leaving. Let's go.
On today's show, Charles Duhigg will offer many more tricks and deeper strategies to help you become more productive, especially in a work environment, but in your personal life as well. First, however, a warning.
There's actually a big tension and a difference between efficiency and productivity. There's actually a big difference between being busy and being productive.
Duhigg's most recent book, Smarter, Faster, Better, combines old-fashioned reporting and a survey of the academic literature to identify best productivity practices. His first book, The Power of Habit, did the same for habit formation. I had assumed the second book was sort of a continuation of the first, but Duhigg sees it as the opposite.
Because The Power of Habit is all about these decisions that you stop making, right? Choices that become automatic, that I simply stop thinking about. Whereas productivity is about re-grabbing control over the choices. Instead of simply reacting to what's in my environment and all the cues around me, it's about sitting down and deciding, I'm in charge about what I do with my time and what my goals are and how I manage my focus and how I control my brain.
I'm curious, when you talk about productivity, what are you talking about? Because I think when a lot of economists think about productivity, we think about them thinking about how to squeeze another widget out of that production line.
Absolutely. And I think for most people, that's not productivity, right? I think what's important to realize is that productivity means different things in different settings. And it's not necessarily what economists mean when they say just getting more widgets out of each machine each hour or more cars off the assembly line for every hour that someone works. Instead, what it means is helping people figure out how to achieve their goals with less waste and less anxiety and less stress and more opportunity to actually enjoy what they want to enjoy. So for some people, that might mean that I'm able to like blow through, you know, 30 emails in 30 minutes and get to inbox zero. But for other people, it means I get to take my kids to school without having to rush and I still feel okay when I get to the office. But most importantly, what productivity really means is it means a different way of thinking.
This is the crux of Duhigg's book, that the only way you'll change your outcomes is to think differently about how you've been arriving at those outcomes. It's one of those statements that is obvious in retrospect, but weirdly non-obvious to a lot of us caught up in the thrum of daily life. For instance,
when electricity was first popularized, there was this huge wave of factories that replaced their steam engines with electrical engines. And almost none of the productivity of those factories rose initially. This has been referred to in the economics literature as the productivity paradox. And as researchers went back and they tried to figure out why, what they found is that all the factory managers had arrayed all of the machines, had lined them up on the factory floor so that they could have these steam pipes that would run from machine to machine. And when they electrified the plants, they left all the machines in the same places. They just replaced the pipes with wires. It took like 20 or 25 years for plant managers to start saying, look, the strength of electricity isn't simply a new power source. It's that we can move these machines in ways that we can have workers work more efficiently, or we can use less people, or we can create an assembly line. And that's where the productivity increase really came from. And the same thing is happening today.
Meaning it's not enough to blithely accept the many new tools that the digital revolution keeps shoving in our hands. We need to rethink how to best use them and toward what end.
There's this debate over whether the digital revolution is really increasing productivity. And when economists and I think people with common sense take a step back, what they say is, look, it's not about all these gadgets and apps. It's about learning new ways to think about possibilities, new ways to think about our capacity for work. And when that really gets spread through the population, that's when productivity really increases.
That debate about how much or even whether the digital revolution is actually increasing productivity has been playing out here on Freakonomics Radio. One episode we did was called Yes, the American Economy is in a Funk, but Not for the Reasons You Think. Another was called How Safe is Your Job? Those conversations dealt mostly with the macro view. But hey, we're all self-interested animals, aren't we? So you want to know what the digital revolution means for you.
All of us only have 24 hours each day, but some people seem to get a lot more done within that 24 hours, and they seem less stressed and sort of worked up about it. And the reason why is not because they're kind of hacking themselves or they're pulling strings. They're not really focused on efficiency. What they're focused on is trying to figure out, what are the right goals that I should be chasing after?
Now, before we get into the specifics of what leads to a more productive life, whether in work or in the personal sphere, persuade us that the examples you'll be using and the data that you'll be presenting aren't cherry-picked. In other words, persuade us that you're not just telling success stories and then reverse engineering them to present seemingly causal factors that might in fact be nothing more than correlation and perhaps even just coincidence.
I talked to, 400 or 500 people for this book. And I had this basic rule, which was that when someone told me something that they felt made them more productive, that I wouldn't include it in the book unless it seemed to be universal. And so if I talked to 400 or 500 people, I probably heard 300 different ideas about how to increase productivity. But what I would find is that one set of ideas would work for a group, and then another group would say exactly the opposite. So a good example of this is like the fanatical devotion on one goal at all costs. When I talk to people in Silicon Valley, they would say, here's the most important thing in being productive, is that you choose like one outcome and you just remain persistent. And then I would talk to people in big companies and they would say, here's the thing about being productive. You have to be flexible. You can't commit yourself to one goal. And this happened again and again and again, except that I did notice that there was this small handful of consistent ideas that kept on coming up. As I boiled through all of these stories and all of these papers that I was reading and all of these experts, there were really only 8 things that came up again and again and again.
Okay, as you heard, according to Charles Duhigg and his band of productivity freaks, there are 8 key tools or skills, and they are... I believe we need a sound effect here, please. Thank you. Number 1, motivation.
We trigger self-motivation by making choices that make us feel in control. The act of asserting ourselves and taking control helps trigger the parts of our neurology where self-motivation resides.
Focus.
We train ourselves how to pay attention to the right things and ignore distractions by building mental models, which means that we essentially narrate to ourselves what's going on as it goes on around us.
Goal setting.
Everyone actually needs 2 different kinds of goals. You need a stretch goal, which is like this big ambition, but then you have to pair that with a specific plan on how to get started tomorrow morning.
Decision making.
People who make the best decisions tend to think probabilistically. They envision multiple, often contradictory futures, and then try and figure out which one is more likely to occur.
Innovation.
The most creative environments are ones that allow people to take cliches and mix them together in new ways. And the people who are best at this are known as innovation brokers. They're people who have their feet in many different worlds, and as a result, they know which ideas can click together in a novel combination.
Absorbing data.
Sometimes the best way to learn is to make information harder to absorb. This is known in psychology as disfluency. The harder we have to work to understand an idea or to process a piece of data, the stickier it becomes in our brain.
Managing others.
The best managers put responsibility for solving a problem with the person who's closest to that problem, because that's how you tap into everyone's unique expertise.
Teams.
Who is on a team matters much, much less than how a team interacts.
Okay, you got that? Motivation, focus, goal setting, decision making, innovation, absorbing data, managing others, and teams. Some of these are obviously more geared toward workplace productivity, but we'll see if we can't smuggle them over the border into the personal realm. I was really taken with your first chapter about motivation, and I wonder if you could talk for a minute about how control plays into motivation. In other words, if I'm a parent wanting to motivate what I think is a lackadaisical teenager in school, what works, what doesn't work, and so on?
So in many ways, the foundation of motivation is what's known as the locus of control in psychology. And everyone either has an internal locus of control, which means that they believe that they control their own fate, or an external locus of control, which means that they think that things just happen to them and they're powerless.
Now, wait a minute. When you say that everyone has one or the other, it can't be that black and white plainly, right? The world is not divided into the external and internal.
But people exist along this continuum, right? And we've all met people who are one way or the other. We've all met people who sort of believe, if I decide to climb that mountain, I can do anything. And others who complain all the time, you know, I wanted to get a better job, but my boss is mean to me, and I'm never lucky, and it doesn't work out. And what's interesting is that the influences of internal versus external locus of control are kind of surprising. Like, for instance, there's been experiments that show that when teachers tell kids that they're really smart, that they did well on a test because they must be really smart, that actually triggers our external locus of control, because most people don't believe that they have any influence over how smart they are. It's either something you're born with or it's not. Whereas when teachers tell kids, you did great on this exam, you must have worked really hard, that reinforces an internal locus of control, because we all know I choose how hard I work. And what we've found is that self-motivation and motivation in general seems to rely on believing like we're in control.
Okay, so the implication is that there's a certain kind of compliment or praise that is more powerful, or that leads to higher productivity, yes?
That's exactly right. What we know is that you can train people to believe that they are in control of their own life, and more importantly, to get them addicted to that kind of pleasant sensation that comes from being in control. One of my favorite examples of this is something that Mauricio Delgado, a neurologist, mentioned to me, is driving down the freeway. You know when you're like stuck in traffic on the freeway and you see an exit, and you know that it would take just as long to get home by taking that exit, but like your brain wants you to like turn the wheel and take the exit even though like it won't get you home any faster? That's because we learn this kind of almost emotional pleasure that comes from taking control.
You can see how you can practice this as an individual, but institutions are trying to improve as well. Duhigg writes about the U.S. Marine Corps overhauling their basic training a while back.
Because they were getting all these recruits who were kind of like wet socks. They didn't know how to self-motivate. And so the guy who was in charge of the Marine Corps, Charles Krulak, who was a general, said, we need to start teaching people to have this internal locus of control. We need to teach them how good it feels to take control, to assert themselves, because then they'll learn how to self-motivate. And so he instituted a couple of rules. And one of them was that you can only compliment people on things that are unexpected. So this drill sergeant told me that he never tells someone who's a natural athlete that they just ran a good race. He only tells like the small kind of wimpy kids that they just did a great job running. The Corps as a whole never tells anyone that there's such a thing as natural born leaders, because that implies that you don't have any control over whether you're a leader or not. Instead, what they do is they compliment shy people who take a leadership role. And they say to them, look, I know it was hard for you to do that, but you did a great job.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how to make to-do lists that really work, how Google learned to build a better team, and how to define productivity on your own terms, as you'll hear in a moment from our listener, Haley McCoy from Bend, Oregon. I love Haley's level of self-examination, and I especially love how many times she can say the words productive and productivity in one sentence and still make perfect sense.
Hi, Freakonomics. I would like to improve my productivity, but I think there's a hidden complexity in the pursuit of productivity. I grapple with the question of what is productive. I like to engage in creative activities like painting, writing, reading, but is that productive? I'm always striving to know how my time would be best spent, which has really made me dive into philosophy lately. I'm also trying to define productivity in my terms. I guess I'll try to be productive in defining productivity for myself so that I can start being productive.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This is my show, which means I more or less lead our production team. As I was reading Charles Duhigg's book about productivity, it's called Smarter, Faster, Better, I had a rather unsettling realization, which I told Duhigg about. In the chapter on teams, you write at some length about the qualities of a good team, but particularly the qualities of a leader of that good team. You're right, teams need to believe that their work is important. Teams need to feel their work is personally meaningful. They need to have clear goals and defined roles. Team members need to know they can depend on one another, but most important, teams need psychological safety. So I have to say, when I read that list, I realized that I am the world's worst leader imaginable. That I don't do any of that. I don't think about it.
Well, I would actually guess that you're better than you're letting on.
You would guess wrong, I'm going to tell you. And you should speak with the other people on my team and they'll back me up.
But I think you hit on something really, really powerful, which is that list of things that you just read, they are not efficient. So one of the things that's really important about creating the right group norms that make a team productive is that everyone has a chance to kind of socialize with each other a little bit, right? Because you want to create this high average social sensitivity. And the only way you do that is to get people to talk about their lives a little bit. Now, we've all had the experience where you go into a meeting and like for the first 5 minutes, people just like talk about their weekend and their kids and who's sick and they gossip. And you think to yourself, God, like, can we please just start this meeting? Like, we got business to get done. And I have that same instinct, which is to say, I want to prioritize efficiency. But study after study shows that if we spend a couple of meetings without 5 minutes of getting to know each other, over time, our group will actually be much, much more productive. And so sometimes it's about sacrificing the short-term efficiency for the long-term productivity.
Duhigg's view of productive teamwork comes largely from a massive research project at Google.
We are lucky beneficiaries of the fact that Google decided to spend millions of dollars in 4 years trying to figure out how to build the perfect team.
Google is consistently named among the best American companies to work for.
And they spent a lot of that time thinking that, like, the question was, who do you put together? Do you put introverts and extroverts? Do you want people who are friends away from the conference table? Or do you want, you know, a flat leadership system or like a really strong leader?
You write a little bit further having to do with Google. And I believe it was Laszlo Bock who runs their, what's that division called?
The People Operations.
Hi, this is Laszlo.
Yes, that's Laszlo Bock, who, when we interviewed him, was Senior Vice President of People Operations at Google.
I'm basically in charge of the care and feeding of our Googlers, our employees, and making sure they get here, they're happy, they're productive, and they stay a long time.
Under Bock, Google ran two productivity studies.
Years ago, we did something called Project Oxygen, and the underlying question behind Oxygen was, do managers matter? And if they do, what can we do to make managers more effective? What can we do to create a place where management is as essential and as helpful as oxygen?
Bock says Project Oxygen was useful, but as important as a manager may or may not be, there's the rest of the team as well.
So we decided to look at teams as a unit of analysis. And Project Aristotle is all about figuring out how to make groups of people happier and more effective.
And Google, being Google, looked at a lot of data.
We looked at 200 different teams across every part of Google, every geography, all around the world, in sales, in marketing, in finance, in engineering, everything we were doing. And the outcome metrics we looked at were not just performance ratings, but measures of, you know, what kind of innovation came out of the team? How quickly were they moving? Did people stay on the team? Did they not? Were people happy? Were they not? What did other people outside the team think of that team's performance? And then we spent a lot of time kind of crunching all those numbers and teasing through the qualitative interview data to try to isolate what actually was making a difference in team performance.
Google's findings did not jibe with a lot of earlier academic research or other conventional wisdoms.
So for example, in the academic research, it says consensus-driven decision-making is often better than sort of top-down direction. Academic research says workload matters a lot. Having teams in the same location. We actually found none of those things were in the top five of what mattered in terms of effectiveness for teams.
Here's how Charles Duhigg puts it.
What matters isn't who is on the team. What matters is how the team interacts.
So we were surprised that these things that everybody kind of says matter ended up not mattering. For example, the most important attribute of a high-performing team is not who leads it or who's on it or how many people or where it is. It's psychological safety.
Which means that everyone at the table feels like they have the opportunity to speak up, and they all feel like each other is actually listening to them, as demonstrated by the fact that their teammates are sensitive to nonverbal cues.
We ask if the team members feel they can fail openly, or do they feel they're going to be shunned by failing. We ask, do they feel as if other team members are supporting or undermining them?
Bach and his team identified five norms that the best Google teams had in common, beginning with psychological safety.
That unlocks all kinds of goodness. Another one of our norms is dependability. Dependability is the notion that you tell me to do something, I'm going to get it done. And you can rely on me to get work done. Structure and clarity, actually two things, but they sort of relate. Basically, the idea is people should know what everyone's job is, and that should be a shared understanding across the team. Another norm is meaning, that the work should be personally meaningful to every person in the room. And the last thing is impact, that team members need to think and believe that their work matters and actually creates change.
Bach admits that most of these norms are pretty obvious, but that doesn't mean everybody uses them. And there are other tricks a good manager should think about. For instance,
are you having regular one-on-ones? Which is obvious, like you should have one-on-ones with your team members. Turns out most people don't because they're not that much fun. They're kind of boring. They take time. But when you do them, your team performs better.
Another example.
Are you making sure everyone in your team feels included? Obvious, kind of logical, we should do that. But not everyone does. If you think about meetings that you may have been in, you know, there's often somebody sitting off to the side who sits quietly for the whole meeting and never says anything. Rarely does the person leading the meeting say, hey, you know, we haven't heard from Frank during this entire meeting. Frank, what do you have to say? Or Gail, you've been silent this entire conversation. Do you have a perspective? And so having a checklist that says, are you checking on these things? Are you calling out the quiet people? Goes a long way to making teams more effective.
But again, effective, like productive, isn't necessarily the same as efficient.
One of the hardest things about looking at team performance is that it's really hard to figure out what outcomes you care about. You know, we want teams in every way to be more productive and efficient, but also happier and stick around longer.
Because continuity, in the end, can be extremely productive for any institution. But let's say you work largely on your own, that you're not a member of any work team, much less a leader. Maybe you don't even have a job per se. Maybe you're a craftsperson or a freelance consultant, or maybe an athlete or musician or a chef. In other words, you are on an island. When you don't have a team leader to keep their eye on you, how do you think about productivity?
I think that in general, people know when they're actually productive.
Charles Duhigg again.
If you sat down with someone and you said to them, are you productive? They would give some anodyne answer, right? Like, yeah, I'm pretty productive, or no, I'm not that productive. And then you would say, like, tell me what you did yesterday. Did you spend your time wisely? I think that people could go through their day and they would tell you, look, I spent a couple of hours like watching soccer with my kid. And that might not seem productive, but honestly, that's really important time that me and my son have together. And then I spent another couple of hours, you know, working on emails. And that might seem productive from the outside, but actually what I should have done is I should have just deleted a bunch more of them or ignored them, because they really won't matter a week from now whether I sent that response or not. That people are very good at actually analyzing whether they're productive or not. The problem is that very frequently we don't stop to analyze. We don't reflect on what's actually happened. And that part of this idea of managing your own brain, learning how your brain works so that you can take control of your focus and your motivation and how you manage yourself and others, is that it forces us to really sit back and analyze, am I spending my time the way that is really meaningful to me, or am I simply reacting to other people's priorities and to the busyness of life?
One thing that I, and I think a lot of people wonder, especially if they are makers, you know, they're responsible for their own projects, their own income, their own schedules and so on. But even if they're purely managers, even if they're working within a firm, I think a big question is how many projects or ideas seem to be the optimal number, you know, too few and we may not get much done, too many, and we may never complete any. So what does the science have to say about that?
There's actually a really interesting study that was done where a couple of MIT academics got access to hundreds of thousands of emails that this one firm had sent. People were corresponding to each other, and they could correlate it with data on how many projects people were working on and how much profits they were bringing in. And what they found is that there's some people who don't work on enough projects. So they might work on two or three things at the same time, and they're just not maximizing their opportunities. But there also are some people who work on like 10 or 12 projects at once, and they're stretched too thin. And as a result, they can't spend enough time actually devoting attention to each project. So what was optimal was the people who were somewhere in the middle. But what was really interesting was that the kinds of projects that they chose were critical to how productive they were. Now, you would think that what people would want to do is that they would want to find a bunch of similar projects so that they're doing the same thing over and over, faster and faster and faster. It's exactly the opposite. The people who were most productive were the ones who were seeking out new and different kinds of projects because it taught them something new with each iteration. That's why they would only work on a handful of projects, you know, four or five at any given time, is because working on something new, it takes a lot of time. To learn takes more time than simply to execute. And yet it turns out that over time, the more you learn, the more value you add. And as a result, the more productive you are.
Talk for a minute about writing the perfect to-do list. And I'm curious to know whether you've been able to follow your own advice.
I have, actually. So it used to be that I wrote to-do lists, I think like most people did. I would start by writing at the top of the page a couple of easy tasks, right? Because I want something that's going to kind of
like— Brush teeth.
Yeah, brush teeth. Or like, you know, read all of my emails or turn on my computer. Sometimes I would actually write at the top of my list things I had already done because it felt so good to like start the day by crossing it off and feeling accomplished. And this is actually, within psychology, this is known as using a to-do list for mood repair. And it's the exact opposite of productive. Because what happens is that I cross a couple of the easy things off, and then I feel like I've accomplished something, and I give myself permission to like go check Facebook. And then 45 minutes later, I pay attention to what's going on again.
Okay, fair enough. But let's say there must be some people who react in exactly the opposite direction, no? Some people who kind of feel like the pump is primed, and I've turned on my computer, and I've brushed my teeth, and I've remembered to, you know, breathe, let's say. Having accomplished all that, now I can, you know, buy that new insurance plan I need to for my firm, which is the thing I've been dreading.
Sure. And the question then becomes, how do you remind yourself of the bigger task? And so what psychologists recommend is that on your to-do list, you have two types of goals. At the top of the page, you write a stretch goal. And a stretch goal should be that big ambition. And then underneath that, you should write something that makes that stretch goal tangible and into a plan. And one of the systems for doing this is this thing called SMART goals, right?
SMART, that stands for specific,
S,
measurable,
M,
achievable,
A,
realistic,
R,
and based on a timeline,
T. SMART.
The SMART goal system was developed years ago within General Electric. Unlike the big stretch goal, with a SMART goal,
you take a component of this big ambition and you say specifically what you want to get done and how you're going to measure it. And is that achievable? Like if you want to do something, do you have to clear your schedule in the morning? Is it realistic? If you're going to clear your schedule in the morning, does that mean that you don't turn on your email at all because you know it's going to distract you? And what's the timeline for getting the sub-goal done? And it's very easy to do this with a to-do list. I do it every single morning and it takes me 45 seconds to figure out what my stretch goal for the day is, what my SMART goal for when I get to my desk, what exactly I'm going to do right away. It's almost a habit, but it transforms how much I get done. Because if you sit down and at the top of your list it says, go buy the insurance plan for my entire company, and then underneath you have this like very distinct plan, like specifically what you're going to do when you first sit down, how you're going to measure it, what you need to do to make it achievable and realistic, how much time it's going to take, it's really easy to start. You've basically gotten over the hump.
That is such a good example. So Charles, it's a little after 5:30 p.m. in the East where you and I are talking. And I'm just curious about your goal for the evening, maybe even your stretch goal for the evening. So some people look at 5:30 and they think cocktail hour. Some people look at 5:30, they think, oh, let me get a little more work done. What's your stretch goal for the night?
My stretch goal is to make it home for family dinner. I have to say, my wife and I have established a family stretch goal of having family dinner at least twice a week during the weekdays. And we've worked backwards to reorganize our days so that we can do that.
Way to go. Bon appetit.
Thanks.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we're often told that one thing above all the rest raises our productivity: going to college. But what do you actually get out of the college experience? That's coming up next. And if you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, check out our website at freakonomics.com, where you can find the podcast, our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Nobody gets to where they get or becomes who they become without some help along the way. Maybe a little help, maybe a lot. So as a writer, I've had a lot of help. People who taught me, whether they knew they were teaching me or not. And you look back and you think about where you get your ethics, your work ethic, your ideas and your way of coming up with ideas. And sometimes you just want to reconnect with those people who helped you and you want to thank them. So not long ago, I had the chance to go back to Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina, where I was an undergrad a bunch of years ago. And I dragooned my three favorite professors into coming by the radio station there, WASU, for this conversation. So I wonder if you guys would take turns introducing yourself. Leon, you want to just say who you are and what you do?
I'm Leon Lewis. I've been a member of the English department at Appalachian for, long time, at least since the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm. Jim?
Okay, I'm Jim Winders. I taught European intellectual cultural history, especially French history, at Appalachian for 30 years. I retired in 2008.
And Joe?
Hey, I'm Joe Murphy. I started teaching here in 1975. I teach in the educational media program, documentary film and film production and video production.
So each of the three of you, when I was a student here, something happened to me in each of your classes, or I learned something in each of your classes. It was often one very, very small thing that I'm guessing that you probably don't recall because so much happens. But in each of these cases, these three things that I learned from the three of you stayed with me. You know, I think anybody that turns themselves into whatever you turn yourself into, a professor, a business person, a writer, you kind of carry around a little book in your mind of ways to live, ways to think, you know, a cheat sheet, Harvey Penick's little red book in golf, right? The rules you live by. And so for me, three of the rules that I've lived by always as a writer, I learned from the three of you. So I went back to Appalachian State University to talk to some of my old professors. At the time, we were working on a Freakonomics Radio episode about the value of college. And I had already interviewed a bunch of economists on the topic, but they all had a blind spot, the one question they couldn't answer. So I wanted to see if maybe my old history and English and film professors could answer it. So let me just ask this question to all of you, and any all of you or none of you, if you hate the question, can answer it. What happens to a college student that creates value? So it seems as though the numbers tell us, and the best economists in the field tell us, that there's a lot of value created at places like this. You take students and you turn them into more productive, healthier, happier people. And I'm just really curious to know from your perspective of three people who've taught for a long time, how you think that transfer of knowledge or that benefit actually happens. It strikes me as some form of wild, wonderful alchemy, and I wonder if you know what you're mixing and matching.
I don't know exactly what goes into the process.
That's Leon Lewis, my old English professor.
Even though I've been at this for a long time, in some ways I'm going on instinct and things that I like talking about and things that I'm interested in, I still think have a great deal of value, and they've kept me energized. But one of the basic things that any English department is going to do is involved with helping students to write as effectively as they can. And I believe to have some sense of your own language, to know what it means, to be able to use it, can not only be useful and productive, but can be extremely exciting. So I'm committed to that and doing the best I can with it.
That is, I think that's a great point because, I mean, you know, one of the ironies of the digital revolution is that people thought that the printed word, the written word would become less important. But the fact is now everybody writes all the time, if only in tweets, right? Jim, I don't know.
What back to your earlier question, you mentioned the word value. And I was very struck by something you said about something that happened in each of our classes is something that stays with you, that you remember and you use all the time. And I think that's really essential, that a classroom is a place where something is going to happen. And no matter how much the professor has prepared, no matter how receptive the student is, there's no predicting what that's going to be. And it always amazes me when a student will tell you years later, I'll never forget the day you said so-and-so. You don't remember saying that, but the student has remembered that, and it has meant something to that person. One of the most important things I think that happens in the classroom is that a certain kind of student discovers for maybe the first time that he or she really has the talent and the capability to excel in writing or you know, some academic skill or, you know, some area of knowledge. It's a revelation to them.
The reason I asked Jim Winders and Leon Lewis and Joe Murphy specifically to come talk was because something happened to me in each of their three classes that would change the way I would think about writing and about working for the rest of my life. Now, I had no idea if they would remember what happened, but I wanted to ask. So, Joe, this is not something you said. I'm going to warn you, it's something a guest said. You had a guest come in, a filmmaker. So, Joe, you taught a filmmaking course that I took, which was a great deal of fun. It was great. And this filmmaker came in to talk about whatever. I literally don't remember who this person was, what kind of films he made, anything. But I do remember this. I had a question for the guy, and it was a kind of smart-ass question. It's embarrassing to say now. And I was he was talking about this, and that, and I raised my hand. I said, well, you know, the stuff you're talking about sounds really great, but our equipment is not very good. Like, we just have a little basic camera. We don't have any budget or anything for light. We don't have this and that, da 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 da. And this guy, in a very friendly but very curt way, said, never, no matter what you are, no matter who you are, writer, filmmaker, blah, blah, you don't blame your equipment. Your equipment is your equipment. You're the creative person. You learn to do what you do with the equipment. He didn't mean to embarrass me, but I was chastised. It was a phenomenal life lesson for me. So I'm just curious as to whether, A, you might have any recollection of that, and B, how that kind of teaching figured into the way that you ran your class, ran your filmmaking life yourself.
Actually, I don't remember that specific incident because there have been many incidents along the years. But I do tend to support that philosophy and always have. I tell students you can be creative with a rock. I mean, it's all creativity is in your head, and too many people use the excuse of I'm going to make my great film as soon as I get my camera. I'm going to make my great film as soon as I get enough money to. No, you can go out there and make a great film tomorrow. I mean, there's ways to do it. You can get a hold of equipment from the library or from there's public access places. I mean, equipment shouldn't be an excuse.
All right, Jim, let me tell you what happened in your class. And I should say, so you're a history professor. The history course of yours that I took was, I think, the single coolest course on the campus. No offense to Leon or Joe. It was called the History of Rock and Roll course that you taught. What I remember this one day is there was an exercise where you gave a sheet of paper and started at the head of the class and supposed to go through it. And the only instruction was to write one line. I think it was very open-ended like that, which I think is what made it so great. And I don't remember if it was supposed to become like a story or a lyric or a description of something we were talking about. Now, do you remember that at all? And was it something you regularly did or no?
I do not remember it at all.
That's great.
All right, well, let me tell you about it then. you were supposed to pass it around, and obviously, you know, you're a human being. You get the sheet. You read what's come before it. And then you think, what's my contribution, and how do I further the cause? Well, again, me being immature and kind of a smartass and kind of a snob, I guess, because I felt like I'm in a rock and roll band. And the line that I wrote was, 20 years ago, this, meaning this exercise that we're doing, this would have been great. And I think what I was trying to say was, if we were all stoned in 1967 or whatever, this kind of free form association bullshit that those people loved so much, yeah, that would have been great. But we're in a more enlightened era now. Then it goes on to the rest of the class, and it's completed. And if I recall correctly, you then read the whole thing, right? And it became this story. And the thing that I remember, it's probably going to make me cry because I feel like so joyful about it and miserable at myself at the same time. The person who'd come right after me took my smart aleck snobby line and just went with it. And just like made a rhyme off it. You know, 20 years ago, this would have been great. Then it was like, you know, something like 20 years ago, walking down straight. Then the next person took it and it became like this wow. fantastic thing. And I felt like such a schmuck. To me, it was about the idea of, you know, coming in as a student thinking I was really smart, you know, thinking I had something to, I had commentary to offer. And in fact, it taught me that this attitude that a lot of writers and artists get of being superior, being, you know what, I personally have come to think that's the worst. As a writer, I think my job is to find out what's going on in the world, talk to people smarter, more interesting than me, write down what they say, and tell people about it. That taught me that arrogance and snobbishness is really, it's counterproductive. So thanks.
It's very interesting.
So you don't remember it.
I really don't. I can think about things in my intellectual background that might have led me to attempt that kind of an exercise, but I have no memory of that event.
Did the way that you taught that course and the way that it was in such demand from a lot of people, did that change the way you thought about the history of rock and roll? And did you learn a lot by teaching that course?
I learned a lot from the people in the course who were interesting and memorable people like yourself, and I cherish those things. My initial response to having taught the course was actually kind of negative. Hmm. It was you know, sort of the sense that either this really can't be taught, or that too many students are not taking the course seriously, or they get stoned and come to class because they think that's cool. I think I got kind of sour on it.
How long did you teach it?
I taught it only 2 years.
You're so kidding. I can't believe you only taught two. I thought this was this legendary.
No, in fact, and now if you look at the Appalachian course catalog, it's a regular fixture in the music school of music. Somebody teaches it all the time.
Yeah.
Gives them, you know, tests on everything. It's something I would never have done.
From talking to Jim and Joe, I'm not sure my memories are at all accurate.
Don't count on me.
You taught this film course, so you're teaching English, but you also started this film program, right?
Well, introduction to film. We're starting with what we called it film appreciation.
Film appreciation.
In those days.
Here's the way the conversation was going. You were lecturing, you were talking about stuff, and I think on this day, if I'm right, you were talking about Citizen Kane, and I think you were talking about Greg Toland, the cinematographer. Not Orson Welles, the director necessarily, at this moment.
Well, you know that collaboration.
Sure,
you don't have to go over that again.
But you were talking about Toland and, you know, the concept of this deep focus and this pulling that was, you know.
I'm still doing it.
All right, good. It was worthwhile. I remember it. See, it was good stuff. So, but here's what I remember. I remember you said, raise your hand to the students, however many there were, 20, 30, 40. Raise your hand if you've seen Citizen Kane, I think was the film, right? Bunch of hands go up, right? And then you said, put down your hand if you've only seen Citizen Kane on television or on a videotape. In other words, if you haven't seen it in a theater with a projector on a screen, and about 90% of the hands, including mine, go down. And you said, why is this important? The people who made this work of art, Greg Toland and Orson Welles, didn't intend for it to be seen on a piece of glass that was 2 feet wide. And there are things in the process of the making that are can only be appreciated or are meant to be appreciated in the format in which they're made. But what it taught me as a writer was, when you write anything. What's your audience? What's your format? What's the way it's going to be perceived now and maybe the way it's going to be perceived 10 years from now? And what you did was you made me appreciate it from the side of the creator, that what Greg Toland was doing wasn't just something cool to talk about. It was the fact that when you have a medium that you can take advantage of, in this case, film, where you can see the pull of the focus, that's an effect. That's something to put in your bag of tricks. So I think about that all the time now. When I'm writing a book, it's one thing. When you're writing a blog or doing radio, it's a different. All these idioms are different. You have different ways to communicate, different things to show, different tools to use. And for that, I thank you, Leon Lewis.
Well, I thank you for recalling that moment. And true confession here, I guess I sort of remember, but that's because last time you were here, you mentioned that moment, whether it was to a larger audience or just to me. So at that point, it was indelibly impressed in my mind. And I'm thinking, if I can remember this next time something like that comes up, and it's going to come up, because look what we've got. We've got people with these tiny little 2-inch devices that are looking at things.
Yeah.
So I may be making, I made that, I do remember kind of, because I did say things in class, but it was out of ire. I was irritated at the fact that people were not getting a chance to have the kind of experience that you could appreciate.
So as a writer, I took away at least 3 life lessons from my college professors. Number 1, do not blame your tools. Number 2, be willing to learn from everything and everybody. And number 3, know your audience, or at least know your idiom. And I have to admit, I was a little disappointed that these lightning bolts didn't strike my professors the way they struck me. But that's part of the magic of education, I think. You might end up learning something that no one even meant to teach. It did make me curious about what they, the professors, get back in return. So I asked.
Well, this is really simple. When a student says, I really liked reading this book that you asked us to look at, and I enjoy talking about it, and I enjoyed writing about it, and I would never have done it before. That seems so fundamental, but it always is very exciting, and it's still very exciting in whatever form there is. When somebody comes across something that you've loved and wanted to share, and they've responded positively, mm-hmm. How can it be better?
Jim and Joe, what do you have?
Well, I think the joys in it are, of course, seeing people be creative. You know, people don't get enough chances to be creative in public school or in university, really. I think there's more opportunities now than there's ever been with new technologies coming out. But to see people in my classes create interesting videos, powerful videos, emotional videos, and that they're really proud of themselves is, I think, the biggest thrill for me.
The most positive thing, for all the good things that happen in the classroom, as wonderful as those moments can be, the most deeply satisfying aspect of teaching for me has been what comes later, the students that you keep up with,
yeah,
who stay in touch with you, taking pride in their achievements and so on, and just ways they've made use of what they studied with you. One of my greatest examples comes recently from a student I had probably 4 years ago, and he recently hiked the Appalachian Trail, the entire Appalachian Trail. He wrote to me and said that on the last days, when he was so sick of it and so weary, he kept repeating to himself he had been in a class where I used Samuel Beckett's writings, my favorite author. And he said, I kept repeating to myself from Beckett, I can't go on, I'll go on.
Now, of course, not every student can be reached. Here's Joe Murphy again.
You got to want it. Yeah. You know, it gets back to the old football coach I had in high school, you know, the pep, you got to want it. And I can tell you, when you were a student, I knew that you would make it because you wanted it. I mean, you got to bring something to the table yourself. And some kids don't, some kids do. That's a tricky thing that I haven't ever been able to figure out. Why do some people want it and other people don't?
Hmm.
Because that's a key. That is really the key. If you want it, you'll get it.
Are you ever able to convert those who don't seem to want it into those who do? I guess that might be one of the hardest things.
I have on occasion.
Things.
It is hard. It is hard. But I have on occasion had people tell me that I got them real excited about film or video and they went into it and they did it. You got to learn to be passionate about something. And hopefully college is a place where you can discover that passion. Because if you don't have any passion in life, who cares, you know?
Well, Leon, Jim, Joe, thanks a ton for joining me today. But moreover, thanks for, everything you taught me and everything you've taught thousands of other students. Job well done. Thanks.
Thank you.
I got to use an Appalachian phrase. Back at you, Steve.
I appreciate it. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.